Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Those, of course, are the beloved closing lines from Robert Frost's famous poem, The Road Not Taken. In pop culture, it's seen as an anthem of individuality and nonconformity, a charge to go your own way, knowing that your courage will lead you on to great adventures. You won't miss out. The only problem is that that's not why Robert Frost wrote the poem. Sorry, I'm going to ruin something for you. He wrote it as a joke. Did you know this? He wrote it to make fun of his friend. You see, Bob often took walks with his friend and fellow poet Edward Thomas, but Ed always consistently struggled to decide which way to go. He couldn't ever pick a footpath. And then after finally choosing a direction, he would then predictably lament that they hadn't gone the other way. And so Robert Frost wrote this poem to poke fun at his friend. And he thought everyone would get the joke, but the trouble was no one got the joke. Frost later wrote to Edward Thomas complaining that after reading this poem to a group of college students, it was, quote, taken pretty seriously, despite doing my best to make it obvious by my manner that I was fooling. It's interesting. A closer look at The Road Not Taken reveals that both paths are equally fair, he says, that both had worn the same. In the end there, he calls the one less traveled, but if you look closely, you see that they are uniformly untraveled, both covered in leaves. So in the poem, the choice of the one path over the other comes down to simple internal impulse of the moment. And that's the joke. Tonight, we stand with the teacher at the head of two paths. As we set out and take a look at each of them, he shares some poetic proverbs along the way. There's a bit of silliness in his illustrations, but make no mistake, the choice before us in this text is extremely serious. He's not poking fun. He's drawing our attention to the most important choice we could make, because one of these paths leads to success in all of the ways that really matter spiritually and eternally and to our hearts, and the other path leads to ruin and destruction and emptiness. So let's take a look. Verse 2, a wise person's heart goes to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. So in the Bible, right and left are often used symbolically, and right symbolically refers to prosperity in the whole of life. We're not just talking about financial. We're talking about a successful life from heaven's perspective, the godly way. It speaks of a strong life, strength in living, fulfillment, all of that. Whereas symbolically, often left in the Bible refers to the way of disaster, man's way, the way of weakness. And so this isn't just a little walk in the woods, a little footpath on the boulevard. This is about the lives that we are living, the direction that we are headed in. This is not like Robert Frost's choice, where both paths are essentially the same. We see that these two paths are going in totally opposite directions. And you are on one of those paths right now. Even if you feel like, well, my life isn't going anywhere, or that you haven't made any major life decisions recently, you are in transit in life right now, because your life is developing, progressing, moving according to the choices that you're making. Notice that for both the wise and the fool, the same thing is propelling them on. It is the heart that drives them on. What does our culture always say? That famous Disney line, follow your heart, right? It's like the tagline, it's the idea, it's the base, you know, principle of every kids and family movie. You can be whatever you want to be, so just follow your heart. Your heart will never let you down. But the problem is, we don't know our own hearts. And when we go to the Bible, where real truth is revealed, it explains to us what's actually going on in our hearts. And we're told there that our hearts are desperately wicked, more deceitful than anything else. More than the media, more than politicians, more than all these other things who are like that, they're lying to us. Your heart is lying to you, your human heart. Apart from God, not submitted to the Word of God, it is lying to you. In fact, the Proverbs tell us that foolishness is something we inherit in our hearts, that it is bound to our hearts. And so when we follow our human hearts, our natural hearts, we are going to go to the left, into folly and into disaster. What we need is not only to, well, I'll go God's way. No, what's propelling us as we move through life? Our heart is propelling us, right? So it's one thing to see this choice before us, but it's like, okay, but my heart is going to lead me in my decision-making and in the activity of my life. And so what we need is to be cured of our heart disease. And what does Christ say he wants to do? In Ezekiel, he comes, he says, I want to remove your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. Christ gives us a new heart, a new mind, a heart and mind that is truly alive, that are filled with God's wisdom and his desires. A heart who, as it beats, its gravitational pull moves us toward the Lord, moves us toward this rightward path. We don't do it perfectly. We don't live sinlessly. But as this heart of Christ is beating with us, and as we walk with him, we're pulled toward him because that's what he's doing in our lives, as opposed to being pulled toward the grave, pulled toward ruin, pulled toward sin, pulled toward temptation. That's what our human heart wants to do. It's a sort of a gravitational rotation thing that's going on. So we need to be cured of our heart disease as we move through life. And so as you read the text tonight and we think about it, we need to consider these two paths. And the question is very obvious. Am I living wisely or am I living foolishly? Because on the one hand, we think of these as two paths that go in completely opposite directions. But the truth is we can take steps on either one of those paths throughout the day, right? You can make foolish decisions or you can make wise decisions. You can believe God, obey him, trust him, and go his way. Or in this area over here, you can say, well, but over here, I'm going to take a quick little jaunt down the path of the fools. And so as we go through this, am I living wisely or am I living foolishly? And we shouldn't assume, it is unwise to assume that, well, I'm never the fool in this passage. The fool is always someone else. The fool is always the dummy or the jerk or the person I don't like in my life, that person that cut me off, that person at work I don't like, the politician I don't like. Those are the fools. I'm never the fool. No, the whole point is that the teacher wants to help us avoid the foolishness in our own hearts so that we can live wisely. Verse 3, even when the fool walks along the road, his heart lacks sense and he shows everyone he's a fool. Dan Allender writes, the fool, I really enjoyed this image. So let's listen to this quote. The fool will follow a path that seems to be right, even when the blacktop gives way to gravel and gravel to dirt and dirt to rocks and rocks to debris, right? You see the breakdown of the path and yet the fool keeps going down it. You see, the fool thinks he has gone the right way. He's convinced that he's made the right decision, just as Lot, Abraham's nephew, did. They had this literal choice. Abraham said, if you go to the right, I'll go to the left. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. We're going to have to separate here. And he let Lot make this incredible life decision. And so Lot looked down toward the offerings of the world, the plains of Sodom. It looked so promising. Look at the wealth out there. Look at the power for the taking. Look at the luxury and the worldly delights that would become his in no time flat. He was so quick to leave the presence of the living God for some lush grass for him and his animals. But then we fast forward and we see where the choices of that foolish decision led him. We see the folly of it. And one of the most amazing aspects of Lot's story is not the trouble he got into, but that while the angels were literally dragging him and his family out of the city, he still was like, but I want to go to another city. As the ground of Sodom crumbled beneath his very feet, his wife is turned to a pillar of salt, he said, and they say, get out of here, get out of the cities, we got to destroy. He's like, but what if I went to that city? It certainly couldn't go wrong for me again. He's a fool. He still thought his way was the best way. As he walks, the fool here in verse 3 keeps telling people, it says, understand there, what he's doing is he's going around and he's telling people that they're dummies. He's saying, he shows everyone, you're a fool, you're a fool, you're a fool. Look how great I am. Look at how smart I am. Look how successful I am. But we see his heart has tricked him. His heart has deceived him. Now, we might laugh at this foolish figure strutting down his path. We know that he's headed over a cliff into destruction, and meanwhile, he's telling everybody, you guys sure are dumb for not following after me, so we might chuckle at that. But what happens when powerful fools cross our path? Well, look at verse 4. If the ruler's anger rises against you, don't leave your post, for calmness puts great offenses to rest. Okay, so maybe the ruler here, this person in authority over you, is a fool themselves. Maybe that's the problem. And they're mad over something they shouldn't be mad at. Or it's possible that maybe you did something foolish and you're getting tuned up for it by this authority figure. After all, we still make foolish mistakes from time to time, despite our best efforts. But either way, you're in this situation where foolishness has led to conflict, and now this authority figure is blowing up in your face. So what should we do? Well, the teacher is very candid. Don't be so easily offended. Grow a thicker skin. Deal with it. Don't resign your post in a huff. And your response shouldn't immediately be, I don't have to sit here and be talked to like that and walk out. Instead, he says, listen, in that situation, the wise thing to do is to respond calmly. Philip Ryken writes, this is the biblical way to deal with fools, not by sharing in their folly, but by living out the character of Christ. And we see here, not only can offenses be settled, but even great offenses can be settled, and that we have a responsibility and a great part to play where it says, hey, let's look at it the most obvious way. Your idiot boss comes to you and blows up in your face for something you didn't do. He's mad at you. It is not your problem. It was not your mistake. The teacher says, you know what you should do in that situation? You should take the responsibility of reconciling that situation calmly. And we would say from the vantage point of the New Testament in a Christian-like manner and say, hey, how can we put this back together? As opposed to responding with the kind of anger and foolishness that has been thrown at you. But the problem is, we don't like to suffer fools, do we? I was at the grocery store today, and I didn't know if I was gonna survive. I sent a message to my wife. I said, I'm pretty sure they added a 10th circle to Dante's Inferno, and I'm in it. Fools in every aisle, fools at every register. And it was the Lord rebuking me, being like, just calm down, you're fine, right? We don't like to suffer fools. We want to dismiss them. We want to get rid of them. We want to demote them. But as usual, we have to remind ourselves as Christians that we have a higher calling to live like Christ. And thank God that Jesus Christ suffers fools, right? Because that's all of us. He suffers our foolishness day by day, moment by moment, again and again and again. He never says, you're doing that again? Ah, this guy can't, you know, you're the cart with one bad wheel, my man. Like, and he never does that. He is long-suffering and compassionate toward us, full of grace toward us. And then he says, hey, guess what? You get to be my body on the earth. You get to have my mind, my heart, my words, my perspective. Now you get to act like me in the world around you. Verse 5, there's an evil I've seen under the sun, an error proceeding from the presence of the ruler. The fool is appointed to great heights, but the rich remain in lowly positions. I've seen slaves on horses, but princes walking on the ground like slaves. Okay, a teacher's not being an elitist snob here. He's accused of that sometimes. He's pointing out that because of foolishness, not to mention futility, which he's spent a lot of time talking about in these chapters, because of these things, stuff's all mixed up in our world. One commentator called it topsy-turvy, right? Isn't our world messed up? Topsy-turvy, things are not the way they should be. And we look at situations in the world and we say, man, where is the common sense? That could be fixed in like 5 seconds if the following people would just do the common sense thing. And instead, even a powerful, mighty king might be infected with foolhardiness, right? While people who should be leaders are relegated to positions far below their abilities. Or one example that perhaps he's giving here with the horses, right? is that horses often in the Bible speak of military action, military members. And so one image here is that you have the inexperienced house servant who doesn't know anything about fighting or battle or the moving of troops. He's in charge. He's on the horse commanding the army while the battle-tested field commander prince is just thrown in with the infantry and be, hey, just shut up and follow along. You're like, hey, that's not right. And that's going to end in defeat, not victory. That's what he's talking about. Now, as people on God's path who have God's wisdom and the perspective given to us by the Word of God, we have the real understanding of what's going on in life. We not only can look at our world and understand how things could be better, how problems could be solved in many cases, but more importantly, in Christ, we actually transcend conventional wisdom, and we are to move through the world relating to it according to what Christ thinks should be. Here's what I mean. So not only can we say, well, I could solve this societal problem, or I could solve this community problem with common sense, but then Christ says, actually, I've called you up even higher. I've given you even deeper wisdom, fuller understanding, heaven's perspective, so that we're not just thinking about how little problems on earth should be solved, but where we understand, no, we need to actually reorder everything, where the greatest among us is the servant of all, where life is not about aggrandizing ourselves, but magnifying the Messiah, where wealth and social status and pleasure and position are not the end goals of a human life, but the glory of God and the furtherance of his kingdom, not ours, right? So not only do we have these instructions in the Word of God of how to have what we would call sanctified common sense and how to not just be dummies because we're always looking inward or we're always self-centered, right? This is the problem with a lot of individuals in our society or rulers in our society. They're at their core self-centered. And as they always look in and want to benefit themselves, they end up hurting society, hurting others. We saw this with the teacher early on in the book where he said, I want to just experience all kinds of pleasure. I want to achieve all kinds of things. And you turn around and you realize he's enslaved tens of thousands of people, right? But then the Lord comes to us and says, not only am I going to give you common sense, not only am I going to give you peace and perspective in the problems of life, but I'm going to help you see things from heaven's perspective, where this is not just about, well, we need to change a law. No. I'm going to explain to you how we change hearts, and how we completely redefine human relationships, and how we build a new institution, a spiritual family on the earth called the church, right? It's a completely, what Aslan would call deeper magic, right? A deeper understanding of what's really true, what's really needed, what's really helpful in a life and in a society. Verse 8, the one who digs a pit may fall into it, and the one who breaks through a wall may be bitten by a snake. So there are at least three different ways you could take these proverbs. One is to recognize that because of sin, the world is now an inherently dangerous place. Fall of Adam and Eve, what happens? One of the things that God came to Adam, and he said, now the earth is going to produce for you thorns, right? He changed the makeup of the world and the cosmos, and now we face inherent dangers in this world, a world of thorns, occupational hazards, right? Being wise means being careful when necessary, which might help us avoid some of those hazards. Not all of them, but it will help if we just apply wisdom to life and think about what we're doing. Or it could be referring to fools being stupid in this passage. Did you hear about the amateur treasure hunter in Brazil? He dug a 130-foot deep hole in his kitchen floor. Here's what happened. He had a dream one night that there was gold beneath his kitchen floor, and he woke up and started digging. And then, obviously, you know how this story ends. One day he was in his kitchen, lost his balance, fell down 12 stories to his death. Okay, that's not hevel. That's not futility. That's a guy being stupid, right? That's foolishness because you did something silly. There's a difference between futility and stupid foolishness in this world. Now, and a third way of looking at this Proverbs could be that, listen, in this world, because God is king over heaven and earth, even though futility reigns for now under the sun, and even though, you know, the devil's doing all kinds of stuff as the God of this world, in an eternal sense and in an ultimate sense, you will reap what you sow, right? We read about this a lot in the Psalms and the Proverbs. The wicked person, the sinner who digs the pit for the innocent person, will fall into it himself in the end. Meaning that you're doing these things to harm someone, you're breaking through a wall to take for yourself, but in the end, you will receive judgment for that. You won't escape that wrongdoing. Now, no matter which way we look at these proverbs here, the point is that we should use our God-given minds to think about the choices we're making. Even though we can't predict the future, obviously, we can do the math and make some forecasts. You can look at what we do know about the world and probabilities and, you know, the laws of the universe that God has put in place. And we should look a little bit ahead in life before we make decisions and then take as wise steps as we can. That's what he's saying here. Verse 9, the one who quarries stones may be hurt by them. The one who splits logs may be endangered by them. And so even if you're being careful, and even if you're doing a good thing and a needful thing, accidents still happen in this world. Tragic accidents in some cases. That's the world we're living in. That's what bothers the teacher so much. Why is the world the way it is? Why isn't it better? Why isn't everything fixed? And then the rest of the message of the Bible is the fix is coming. Sometimes, you know, if you follow your Android or your iPhone, it's like a weird bug develops and they're like, a patch is coming. A patch is coming in a week or whatever, and we'll fix that problem. And so the fix is coming. It's just that the Lord is long-suffering and wants more people to repent and to be able to receive eternal life through Jesus Christ. And so he waits. And while he waits, as we've talked about in previous verses and studies, these sorts of hevel accidents happen. The fallen world is in decay, and we walk in its midst. Now, that doesn't mean that we should give up on doing life. Right? Look at the elements here. They're super basic, wood and stones, right? So in that time, the idea of quarrying stones and splitting wood, I mean, this is basic human activity that you would need to do to build things and to make fires and to make tools and all of that. So it's not like this is an unusual thing people are doing. You can't say, well, I might get hurt in the quarry, so I won't live life. I won't do anything. I'm just going to sit in a room and hopefully I won't get hurt. That's not the point. We have to accept risk in life. Withdrawing from life is a waste of life. And all of us accept risk all the time, right? That taco truck you eat at, you're accepting a significant amount of risk. You all got in a car, or almost all of you got in a car to drive here tonight. We accept certain risks in life. And so because you know the world is futile in the sense of hevel and accidents happen and tragedies happen, it doesn't mean we say, okay, well, then I'm just going to live afraid. The teacher says, don't do that. You still have to live life. But let's think about not just the literal aspect of this for a moment. Let's think about the spiritual or more of the mental aspect here. There are things we need to do that are necessary for a healthy life, things like being regularly connected to a local church. We go to the New Testament and it is abundantly, very plainly clear, we need this, right? We all need to be connected to a local spiritual family, like living stones being knit together, the book of Ephesians says. That's only one of the examples where the Bible and the New Testament explains that, hey, we need this. So good job, everybody's doing it. But yet there are many Christians out there, I'm sure you all know some, who say, well, I love Jesus and I believe in God, but man, I got hurt by the church, so I don't go there anymore, right? They're unwilling to accept any potential risk. They've given up. I got hurt, the rock fell on my foot or bashed my head, and now I'm not going to do it anymore because I want to not get hurt like that. I get it. And I'm not making light of the difficulties that people go through sometimes at other churches or our church. You know, life's hard. You know why? Because we're all fools at heart, and we all do make mistakes. But end of the day, as far as the Bible is concerned, that attitude is just wrong, that I'm not going to go to the quarry anymore. I'm tired of trying to get, you know, with these other living stones. It's just not worth it. It's not worth the risk. Yes, we all make mistakes. Sometimes we hurt one another. But quitting the quarry doesn't lead you to a healthy spiritual life. It robs you of the basic elements, right? It robs you of the basic wooden stone that you need to live a healthy and successful spiritual life. And remember, what did we learn just a few verses ago? Even great offenses can be settled and put to rest as we fear God and walk in his wisdom. Not always easy, not always done correctly. I'm not suggesting that, but this is what's being laid before us this evening. We can't just simply be afraid to take risks of life that we so much so that we refuse to live the life God has given us. God has given you a life. With a life with particular commands and particular opportunities, and he's scattered you into time and space, where you are, when you are, for reasons that he wants you to walk in and discover. And if we say, well, but I don't want to stub my toe, break my ankle, you know, get bumped or cut off along the way, so I'm just going to tap out and sit this one out. It's not okay. That's not the wise way of living. Verse 10 says, if the axe is dull and one does not sharpen its edge, then one must exert more strength. However, the advantage of wisdom is that it brings success. So, very basic, wisdom can make life easier. Not all the time. It can't guarantee that everything will go smoothly all the time, but it can, in general, make life easier. Don't we want life to be easier? I do. And on the flip side, foolishness makes life needlessly difficult. It's hard enough to chop wood. It's even harder if you don't take the time to just take the time to sharpen your axe for a minute. And the fool's like, no. And then, but then complains about how hard it is to chop the wood. And then he hurts himself. And he's like, I shouldn't have even been in this forest chopping this wood. That's the idea. And so sharpen your axe, hone your skills, improve your understanding, learn from others, get wisdom, Solomon would say in the Proverbs. Get it and apply it and treasure it. Verse 11, if the snake bites before it is charmed, then there's no advantage for the charmer. In certain cases, wisdom might actually save your life. Now, there's a couple of ideas sort of nestled in this proverb. The first is about using wisdom to prioritize what needs doing now. If there's a snake at your feet about to bite, but your shoes are untied, which problem are you going to solve first? I would urge you to deal with the snake first, right? That's the idea. For you procrastinators out there, just be careful about what you're putting off to do tomorrow. It may not be a real snake biting you, but don't pretend it doesn't cost you something to put it off to tomorrow. I am not a procrastinator by nature. I know some people are. It makes me break out in a cold sweat. Why don't we just do this right now? No, let's wait till we have 1 minute to get it done. You're like, okay. But so that's the idea. It's like, hey, I need to use wisdom to prioritize what needs to be done in life. But also consider this. The teacher always wants us to keep our impending death in mind. As I've been saying a bunch of times in this book, you are not only going to die someday, you are dying right now. And I am dying right now. Some of us at a faster rate. Some of us are dying right now sooner than we think we're going to, right? But every single person in here has a date with death. You are dying right now, and the teacher wants us to keep that fresh in our minds all the time. It's coming to bite you. It is a viper slithering your way. What are you going to do about that? What is your answer? Because you are not a snake charmer. You do not know how to deal with the venom of that bite. Do you have what you need to survive death? Even better, have you found the person who takes the teeth out of death? Jesus Christ overcomes death, defeats it. And he says, death, where's your victory? Grave, where's your sting? You can't bite anymore. If you've read Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book, there's a great moment where Mowgli goes down to this certain place to get this treasure, and everyone tells him there's this I think it's the white viper, and he's down there, and they're like, hey, the white viper kills anybody who goes down there, and he has done so for generations. Well, Mowgli's brave, or maybe foolish, and he goes down there, and he has a talk with the white viper, and Mowgli figures out that the white viper has no teeth anymore. Thuu, he keeps calling him Thuu, you have no teeth. And sure enough, the white viper has no power over Mowgli, and he takes the treasure unto himself, right? And so that's the idea. As a Christian, death has no sting. It has no victory. It has no teeth anymore. But if you're not a believer in Jesus Christ, if you've not been washed in his blood and robed in his righteousness, oh, death is going to bite you and drag you down to the grave. And there is no escape for you. And so what are you going to do about your date with death? Verse 12, the words from the mouth of a wise person are gracious, but the lips of a fool consume him. So at this point, I know it's easy for me to say, well, thank goodness I'm not the fool in this passage. He seems like a big old dummy, so I'm good. But let's remember the many warnings we receive as believers in the New Testament, especially about our words. James in particular really hammered home this idea about watching our words because he said none of us have fully tamed our tongues. And so we need these reminders because as James says, we all stumble in many ways, in particular with the things we say. And what we learn is that we can diagnose the heart. Remember, the heart is what's motivating, driving, propelling us down whichever path of life we're on. And we can diagnose the health of our heart by looking at our words. You send your words to the lab and get the numbers back and say, ooh, your heart, man, we need some medical work here. As wise people walking God's path, our words should fall into the category of grace. We're saved by grace. We should speak with grace. But again, remember the context. We're walking through life in this fallen world, going God's way as much as we can, but dealing with the fools that come through our path. We have to interact with them. We have to speak with them. The calling of God is that we speak with undeserved favor toward people. Obviously, that doesn't mean that we never bring up problems or that we never, verbalize mistakes or issues that we're having, but let's be less quick with the phrase, I want to speak with your manager, right? Let's be gracious. Grace is the way. Verse 13, the beginning of the words from his mouth is folly, but the end of his speaking is evil madness. Words matter. They matter so very much. And especially in the social media age, we're so convinced by the enemy that it doesn't matter what you type, it doesn't matter what you say, it doesn't matter what you publish. And even here, you see it in the halls of our government, right? The Senate confirmation hearings is my favorite. They're like getting ready to confirm the person, and they're like, did you say this? I'm going to kill everybody. Did you say this 5 years ago on Twitter? That's taken out of context. It's like... I can neither confirm, I can't recall. That's you, right? And so we live in a society that has cheapened the barfing of words, but words still matter. Look at what the words of the fool do in this verse. He may start by saying, I'm just fooling, but before he knows it, they've borne the fruit of raving wickedness. So seeing the impact of the fool's words, it should cause us to measure our own words because words can destroy lives. Words can destroy relationships. They can destroy churches and institutions and industries. The truth is, you married people, you could go home and probably say one sentence to your spouse that might destroy your relationship forever, right? And so words matter, and we should care about them, the words that we're saying, the words that we are taking in. Now, the answer is not for us to, okay, well, then I will come up with a list of approved words and phrases to make sure I just say the right things all the time. No, that's not how it works. Because remember, where do the words we use come from? They come out of the heart, right? And so the answer is proper heart health. And when our hearts are in proper shape before the Lord, then we're able to speak as Paul commanded. What did Paul say in Colossians 4? He said, to us, let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you should answer each person. So it's not that we come up with a list like the Pharisees of, here's what I say in this situation, here are the words that I use, and as long as I use these words and not those words, I'm good. No, Paul understood that you're going to be in all these different situations with all of these different people, and the Lord has tailored what he wants you to say to those people in many cases. And so the way for us to know what we should say to each person is to have a healthy heart, full of grace, bearing the fruit of grace. And we can tell if that's happening by the words that are coming out. Verse 14, yet the fool multiplies words. No one knows what will happen, and who can tell anyone what will happen after him? So the fool has no idea where he's headed, but he's absolutely sure he knows the way. That's what's happening here. Be careful of people who come to you as self-proclaimed experts when they've never been where they're telling you to go. Don't read a marriage book from someone who's not married, parenting book, someone who's not a parent, a book on successful fulfillment in life when they're not a Christian. At very best, they're the teacher, and he says, I don't even know why I'm alive. My whole life is a waste, right? So that's what we're talking about. Verse 15, the struggles of fools weary them, for they don't know how to go to the city. What does that mean? As one commentator puts it, the fool gets lost if you put him on an escalator, right? It's a silly image, but some people are stumbling through life that way because they have no direction. What's directing them? They're being driven by their own human urges, their temptations, by fallen conventional human wisdom. They're blown about in the wind. They don't know how to get to the city. They certainly don't know how to get to the heavenly city, the final port where they want to go, but even in life, they're just being blown about. There they are, at the bottom of a pit that they've fallen into, holding a dull axe with a bunch of snake bites, shouting up at you that, I'm going to tell you like it really is. Listen to me. That's the image all compiled together here. And the teacher's like, be careful. Number one, don't be that person. And number two, don't listen to those people. The thing is, in this world, it might be a king down there in the pit. He might have beautifully royal robes on and all his treasure down there. He might have all of his court attendants down there with him, but folly's still folly. And we need to see how the world really is. We need to see the truth of choices and what the Lord really says is the end destination of these things. Verse 16, woe to you, land, when your king's a youth and your princes feast in the morning. So the word doesn't only mean a very young king. It can also mean just a man-child, right? Well, but what about all those times when the teacher told us to enjoy feasting, you know, to enjoy our meals and all of that? Yes, we are called to enjoy the lives we've been given. But this, again, is a heart issue. Instead of waking up each day to lead his people and improve his society, this fellow wakes up and starts to party. His life is about selfish pleasure at the expense of the people around him. Think of King Belshazzar in Daniel 5. He says, man, I'm here, time to party. That lasted about 5 minutes, and then he was dead. And he was the king of the greatest empire at the time, and the next morning his empire did not exist. You're all Medes and Persians now. Oh, okay, right? Verse 17, blessed are you, land, when your king is the son of nobles and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. And so the feasting isn't the problem. It's the heart behind it. Here's a king who's thinking about how to lead, how to protect his people, how to improve his nation, who knows that he needs personal strength to do those things. By the way, noble here isn't used because, again, the teacher's a classist. That's not it. It refers to a person of high moral character. Now, we're not kings or queens, but there is still an application for us. We have a spiritual and societal duty to grow up. And it's a duty that more and more, I would say, Americans are walking away from. We have a duty to mature. What did the Apostle Paul say? He said, when I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child, and when I became a man, I put aside childish things. We're to grow up as we walk with the Lord, not remain childish. That we grow in our ability to exercise self-control and thoughtfulness and selflessness and tact and moderation and grace towards others. Peaceful hearts, not constantly offended like petulant children. Verse 18, because of laziness, the roof caves in, and because of negligent hands, the house leaks. And so the teacher has spent a lot of chapters talking about our hevel world, the futility of our world, but you can't blame this on hevel. This is, again, just foolishness causing problems. Verse 19, a feast is prepared for laughter and wine makes life happy and money's the answer for everything. Amen. No, this is not a life verse for any of us. Instead of being wise, instead of maintaining the roof and the home, the fool spends all his money on a party for himself. And when the drips start pouring in, they sing verse 19, which some scholars believe may have been a drinking song at the time. And they just say, just throw some money at it and it'll be fine. Our government does this, of course, right? Just throw money at these things. But do the problems ever go away? No. In fact, they often multiply. They don't go away without wisdom. Money doesn't solve anything if it doesn't come with wisdom. It is useful, but eventually it will dry up. And if it's wasted and lost and the leak isn't actually fixed, well, then we have even bigger problems. And so the answer is to walk in wisdom rather than folly. Verse 20, do not curse the king even in your thoughts, and do not curse a rich person even in your bedroom, for a bird of the sky may carry the message and a winged creature may report the matter. No sorcery happening here. Has anyone ever come up to you and said, a little bird told me, and then you had to, and then your eyes got big when you realized something you had done or said is out? This is a closing reminder that wise living demands wise speaking. Be careful, especially when you are using sharper words. Well, this king deserves it. Look at this king in chapter 20. Yeah, absolutely. He deserves to be criticized, maybe. But we still have a God-given duty to respect authority, and we need to be honest about the fact that the words we speak are also seeds being planted in our relationships, in our communities, in our own hearts, seeds that will bear fruit. And so two paths diverge before us here, the foolish and the wise. We are called to the wise way, the other way. Calmness, not cursing. Grace, not griping. Thoughtfulness, not impulsiveness. A way of life that is different than what the world does. A way that leads to rest, not ruin, fruitfulness, not futility, destination, not disaster. And as we walk this path, our lives will benefit and the lives around us will benefit. But most importantly, we'll be headed in a true direction, the right destination, and fulfilled by our relationship with God along the way.